Nemoto presents Pioneers of Psychology and Psychiatry, B.F. Skinner. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 27 minutes. Minneapolis, 1943. In the dim light of a basement laboratory, 8 wooden boxes line the wall, each with a single restless pigeon inside. In one box, a white-feathered pigeon turns a slow circle to the left, again and again, its head bobbing in a curious dance. In another, a bird keeps pecking at the empty air as if an invisible seed floats just out of reach. The room is hushed except for the whir of a fan and the occasional metallic click of a feeder mechanism. Every 15 seconds, click, a hopper swings out in one of the boxes, delivering a few grains of food. The pigeon that had been turning in circles rushes to the hopper and gobbles the reward. Across the room, Burhus Frederick Skinner watches intently, a notebook in hand. He notes that this pigeon, by sheer chance, had been spinning in place when the food first appeared. Now, as if believing its peculiar dance conjures the grain, the bird keeps spinning, hungry for the next reward. One by one, each pigeon has developed its own ritual. One sways its head side to side, another pecks at the corner, another bobs as if curtsying, all under the spell of a chance connection. To an outside eye, it looks absurd, almost comical. But Skinner sees a profound principle taking shape behind those glass panes. Here in this quiet lab, with war raging across the world outside, a fundamental question is being asked. Are these creatures free at all, or are they prisoners of pattern and reward, dancing to a tune they cannot perceive? He did not arrive at this question by accident. Skinner was born in 1904 in a small railroad town in Pennsylvania, raised in an environment that prized hard work, ingenuity, and clear rules. As a boy, he delighted in building contraptions, homemade wagons, pulley systems, even an automatic mechanism to separate ripe berries from green. He had a tinker's mind and a fondness for things that worked with clockwork precision. Yet he also harbored a love for literature and initially set out to become a writer. In the 1920s, a young Skinner poured his energies into fiction, hoping to discover some great truth about human nature in prose. But he grew disillusioned. He found he had nothing to say that satisfied him. Restless and searching, he stumbled upon the writings of psychologists who treated behavior itself as a science, most notably John Watson, who boldly claimed that all human behavior, even the mind itself, was nothing more than responses to stimuli, shaped and controlled by the environment. This was a revelation. Abandoning the writer's life, Skinner enrolled in graduate studies in psychology at Harvard. If human nature was to be understood, he decided it would not be through introspective poems or philosophizing, but by methodically watching what living creatures do and how the world around them molds those actions. At Harvard in the early 1930s, psychology was just starting to drape itself in the rigor of natural science. Building on the work of Ivan Pavlov, who had famously conditioned dogs to salivate at the sound of a bell, researchers were beginning to map the laws of learning. Skinner immersed himself in this effort. He had a keen sense for apparatus and measurement. In a small room bristling with wires and levers, he designed a new kind of experimental setup, a soundproof box with a lever or a key an animal could press, a device to dispense food, and a cumulative recorder that inscribed the animal's responses as an inked line crawling across paper. With this invention, later simply called the Skinner box, he set out to probe how animals learn new actions. Where Pavlov's dogs had shown how reflexes could be conditioned by pairing stimuli, bell with food, Skinner was interested in a different kind of learning, one that hadn't been systematically studied before, how an animal comes to perform voluntary actions, like pressing a lever or pecking a disc, and how those actions are shaped by their consequences. In experiment after experiment with rats and later pigeons, Skinner discovered something both simple and staggering. When a hungry rat in the box happened to press the lever and a pellet of food dropped in, the rat would eat and then gradually press the lever more and more often. The consequence, the food reward strengthened the behavior that preceded it. This was different from a reflex. It was as if the animal was learning what works and repeating it. Skinner named this process operant conditioning to signify that the animal operates on its environment and, depending on the outcome, either repeats the action or abandons it. If a behavior is followed by a satisfying result, it is reinforced and likely to occur again. If it leads to no reward or a negative outcome, it fades away. Over time, complex chains of behavior could be built by reinforcing successive small steps, a method Skinner called shaping. An animal could learn to approach the lever, then touch it, then press it, all by rewarding each incremental movement in the right direction. What had once required chance or intuition could now be achieved by design, with timing and patience. Behavior Skinner was showing could be engineered. He tested the limits of these principles with a kind of playful rigor. Could a pigeon be taught to peck a target in order to receive food? Yes, easily. He had pigeons pecking at little discs whenever a light came on and stopping when it went off. Could they learn to distinguish between different colors or shapes for a reward? Yes, they could peck only when a red light shone and refrain when a green light appeared, showing they could discriminate cues for reward. Could two pigeons be taught to play a simplified ping pong, batting a ball back and forth for bits of grain? Astonishingly, yes. Skinner demonstrated exactly that at a scientific exhibit, delighting onlookers with what careful reinforcement could achieve. In one imaginative wartime project, he even trained pigeons to become living guidance systems for missiles, pecking at an image of a target to steer a bomb toward it. The project never saw combat use, but the very attempt showed how far Skinner was willing to push the idea that learned behavior could replace expensive machinery. To him, a pigeon was not just a creature with a tiny mind. It was an organic robot that could be programmed through rewards to perform astonishingly precise tasks. By 1938, Skinner had compiled his findings and theories in a book titled The Behavior of Organisms. In it, he laid out a vision of psychology as a science of behavior with no need to refer to mysterious internal mental states. The book described the difference between Pavlovian conditioning, which he called respondent conditioning, and the new terrain he was mapping, operant conditioning. It also hinted at the broader implications. Perhaps all behavior, human as well as animal, followed these laws of reinforcement. Published at the cusp of World War II, the work initially made only modest ripples. But as the war ended and psychology boomed in the mid-20th century, Skinner's ideas found a powerful current. In the United States especially, a generation of psychologists, eager to establish their field as rigorously scientific, gravitated toward behaviorism, the approach that treated behavior as the only valid subject of psychology and shunned unobservable notions like mind or will as relics of unscientific thinking. In the vanguard of this movement, Skinner became both influential and controversial, a figure embodying the new, tough-minded empiricism, who at the same time raised disquieting questions about human freedom and dignity. Skinner's laboratory success with rats and pigeons convinced him that the differences between these creatures and ourselves were of degree, not kind. Yes, humans are more complex, our behaviors more elaborate, but fundamentally, he argued, we learn in the same way, through the consequences of our actions. What we call free will, in his view, is an illusion, albeit a convincing one. A person feels free when they do not sense the influences acting upon them. But every action, he would say, has causes if we look closely enough. Our genetic endowment, our upbringing, the rewards and punishments that have sculpted our habits since childhood. If one could know all those variables, one could, in principle, predict and control behavior as reliably as an engineer controls a machine. To many, this sounded like a frightening reduction of human beings to clockwork automatons. But to Skinner, acknowledging the programmed nature of behavior was liberating in a different sense. It meant we could change the contingencies and thus change the behavior for the better. We need not blame people for being bad or morally failing. Instead, we could fix the environment that produced the undesirable behavior. Give me a child and I'll shape him into anything, one early behaviorist had boasted. Skinner almost took this literally. He believed that with proper use of reinforcement, children could be guided to become creative, kind, productive, whatever we chose, within the bounds of their physical abilities. And he was keen to prove it not just in theory, but in practice. In the late 1940s, after moving on to faculty positions and continuing his research, Skinner turned to the wider canvas of society. The war's end had left many questioning how humanity might build a more peaceful, just world. Skinner's answer was characteristically concrete: engineer society through behavioral principles. In 1948, he published a novel called Walden 2, imagining a utopian community run on the principles of positive reinforcement. In this fictional community, children were raised communally and trained from birth with kindness and consistency to be cooperative and curious. Work was organized so that tasks were intrinsically rewarding or made pleasant through social praise. There were no harsh punishments. Undesirable behaviors were corrected by calmly adjusting the conditions and reinforcements. The citizens of Walden too led productive, creative lives, free from the scourges of jealousy, aggression, and competition. At least that was the vision. The novel's characters debate whether such a life is fulfilling or whether it robs people of something essential: freedom, individual achievement, the dignity of overcoming adversity. Skinner, through a spokesman in the novel, argued that what people call freedom is often the freedom to be miserable, to be controlled by negative practices. Better to surrender the illusion of freedom and knowingly embrace a benevolent technology of behavior that would actually deliver what people need: food, shelter, meaningful work, harmonious relationships. Walden, too, was both admired and scorned, admired by those who, in the optimistic flush of the post-war era, hoped science could reform society, and scorned by others who saw it as a thinly veiled blueprint for a technocratic dystopia, a world of smiling but controlled citizens. For Skinner, these ideas were not merely abstract theories. He was eager to apply behavioral science to everyday life, even in the nursery. When his second daughter was born in 1944, he designed a special crib he called the Baby Tender, an enclosed, temperature-controlled cot meant to keep the infant comfortable and safe while reducing the drudgery of child-rearing. The baby's sleeping space was a tall, glass-fronted box with filtered air, maintaining a warm, hygienic environment so that she could lie in just a diaper without blankets. Skinner saw it as an ingenious improvement on the traditional crib, freeing the baby from feeling cold or confined, and freeing parents from constant worry about drafts or tangled bedding. The child, of course, was taken out frequently for play and affection, but rumors swirled that the famous behaviorist was raising his child in a box as a heartless experiment. Years later, lurid urban legends would even claim, falsely, that she had come to harm because of it. In reality, Skinner's daughter grew up healthy and well-adjusted, and the family recalled the air crib with fondness for the convenience it provided. But the public reaction laid bare how deeply Skinner's philosophy troubled people. The notion of engineering a child's environment so directly, however benevolently, touched a nerve. To many, it seemed to confirm their fears. Was this scientist trying to take the warmth and spontaneity out of human life and replace it with a clinical apparatus? Skinner, bemused by the controversy, defended his intentions as humanitarian. But the Baby Tender episode foreshadowed the pushback he would face as he carried his ideas from the lab into the fabric of human life itself. As decades passed, Skinner became perhaps the most famous psychologist of the 20th century, and certainly the most contentious. By the 1950s and 1960s, behavior modification based on his ideas was being applied widely. Therapists used token economies, systems of rewards, to encourage good behavior in psychiatric hospitals and schools. Teachers designed programmed instruction, breaking learning into small steps with feedback and reinforcement, an educational innovation Skinner championed. Parents read popular articles on how to raise children with attention to positive reinforcement rather than punishment. Animal trainers in circuses and zoos applied operant conditioning to teach elephants to lift feet or pigeons to play ping pong, often directly citing Skinner's work. It seemed there was no domain of life where these ideas could not reach. And yet, at the same time, a growing chorus of voices pushed back against the exclusively behavioral view of humanity. Noam Chomsky, a brilliant linguist, published a scathing review of Skinner's attempt to explain language through conditioning, arguing that children say novel, creative things that they could never have simply been reinforced for in the past. The mind, Chomsky insisted, had structures and rules that behaviorism could not see. Cognitive psychologists began to study memory, perception, and thought using rigorous experiments, treating the mind as an information processing system, a kind of complex machine in its own right, but one that needed to be understood on its own terms, not only via behavior. At the same time, humanistic psychologists like Carl Rogers and Abraham Maslow, Skinner's own contemporaries, though philosophical opposites, argued that psychology had to account for internal experience, free will, and personal meaning, qualities that made us human. The grand pendulum of psychology was swinging. Behaviorism, once the bold frontier, was increasingly seen by many as too narrow, even dehumanizing. Skinner, ever the unapologetic experimenter, did not retreat. Instead, he doubled down. In 1971, with the world around him embroiled in debates about civil rights, personal liberty, and social upheaval, the 67-year-old Skinner published Beyond Freedom and Dignity. It was an intentionally provocative title for a book that extended the logic of his life's work to society at large. In it, he argued that the cherished ideals of individual freedom and dignity, as traditionally conceived, were actually barriers to a scientific understanding of humans. So long as we insisted that people were free agents freely choosing their actions, we would refuse to see how they are in fact controlled by environments, and thereby lose the chance to control those environments wisely. So long as we placed absolute value on personal autonomy and honor, we would shrink from methods that might change people for the better, seeing such intervention as an affront to their dignity. Skinner urged that we must get beyond these outdated notions. We must recognize that environment is the sculptor of behavior and, with that recognition, deliberately design environments through education, laws, cultural practices that reinforce productive, positive behaviors on a large scale. Only then could we tackle issues like war, poverty, and crime effectively. It was, in essence, a manifesto for social engineering by positive reinforcement. The reaction was explosive. Here was a scientist calmly suggesting that freedom itself is a problematic idea and that we should manipulate human behavior for optimal outcomes. To many, this smacked of totalitarianism, or at least an unacceptable reduction of the human spirit. Reviewers accused Skinner of wanting to turn society into a giant pigeon box. Others, however, saw insight. Perhaps they mused, "We already are controlled by our environments in haphazard ways, by advertising, by propaganda, by social pressures, so why not at least use science to make those influences benevolent?" Skinner found himself on talk shows, at lecture podiums, facing as many hostile questions as curious ones. He answered all with the same steady, matter-of-fact tone he used in his scientific writing. He was not a zealot foaming at the mouth. He was disarmingly calm, as if describing a simple set of facts. But this calmness itself unsettled people, as if he lacked appreciation for the depth and mystery of human life that would be trampled by his behavioral blueprints. Through all the controversy, Skinner continued experimenting, writing, and revising his ideas, almost until his final days. He lived to see the cognitive revolution firmly establish itself in psychology by the 1980s, and he remained a sometimes solitary defender of the old creed that behavior, what can be observed and measured, must be the anchor of science. In one of his last public appearances, He accepted a Lifetime Achievement Award and used his speech not to reminisce, but to critique cognitive psychology for reintroducing, in his view, fuzzy mentalistic concepts. In a way, Skinner never budged from his position on the far end of the freedom conditioning spectrum. He chose mechanism over meaning as the path to truth, believing that meaning, in terms of inner purpose or conscious choice, was either an illusion or simply another behavior to be explained. If Wundt, decades before, had tried to balance the subjective and the objective, Skinner unapologetically tipped the balance entirely to the objective, even if that meant treating love as a series of reinforcements or creativity as the recombination of past rewarded actions. He was willing to go to those extremes if it meant psychology could be a science as powerful as physics. And yet, the story of Skinner and behaviorism is not one of unmitigated victory of mechanism over freedom. In the long run, the legacy of his work did not erase the idea of human agency, but it did temper it. We know now, more clearly than ever, how habit and reward loop through our daily lives, how we reach for our phones for the tiny dopamine hit of a notification, how we form routines sometimes without realizing it, how slot machines and social media feeds alike are designed with variable rewards, the very schedule of reinforcement Skinner found most effective at cementing a behavior. In the 21st century, in an age of AI algorithms and big data, we might even say we live inside a Skinner box of our own making at times. Our choices nudged by subtle reinforcements delivered by our devices and online environments. The question Skinner raised, are we really free? Or are we driven by forces we can observe and manipulate, have only gained new forms? Tech companies apply A/B testing, a descendant of behaviorist experimentation, to see which design keeps us clicking longer. Machine learning models use reinforcement learning, a direct conceptual heir of Skinner's work, to train AI agents to achieve goals by maximizing rewards programmed by developers. Each time an AI figures out how to play a video game or drive a car through repeated trial and feedback, it pays homage to the principles discovered in that quiet lab with rats and pigeons. Yet we, as humans, still cherish our sense of freedom and meaning. We resist the idea that we are just pigeons in a box. And psychology, after Skinner, has largely embraced a more nuanced view. Yes, environment shapes behavior profoundly, but humans also interpret their environment, think, plan, and choose. The struggle Skinner made so stark, freedom versus conditioning, meaning versus mechanism, remains a central tension. Perhaps the truth lies in a middle way. We are neither utterly free nor completely programmed, but a complex interplay of will and circumstance. Skinner's life's work, in all its single-minded clarity, forces us to confront the programmed aspect. He stripped away comforting pretensions and showed us the leverage points where behavior can be guided. In doing so, he changed psychology forever, even if psychology eventually reincorporated the mental realms he tried to cast out. Now, as we imagine Skinner in that Minneapolis basement again, we see the scene with fuller perspective. The pigeon in the box keeps dancing its peculiar dance, captive to a coincidence it mistook for causation. Skinner jots another note, the faint trace of satisfaction on his face. He knows the bird is not free, that its dance is dictated by the timing of grains it cannot control or understand. In that pigeon, he sees a reflection of ourselves, clinging to rituals, believing in lucky charms, feeling in command while unseen contingencies tug at our lives. For a moment, one can almost feel a sting of existential loneliness in that lab. The pigeon alone in its box, the man alone with his theories that set him apart from many of his peers, both creatures in a world of consequences. But Skinner's gaze is steady. The light of inquiry in his eyes suggests no despair, only curiosity and resolve. If the pigeon's dance challenges our pride, so be it. We must follow where the facts lead. A timer ticks, another click sounds, another morsel arrives, and the pigeon devours it greedily. The dance goes on. And Skinner, pencil in hand, bears witness to this small, contained destiny, one tiny part of his grand attempt to chart the laws of behavior and, perhaps, use them to reshape the fate of humanity itself. For all the controversy that would swirl around him, this quiet scene captures the crux of Skinner's legacy. The lever, the grain, the turning pigeon, they force us to confront an uncomfortable question. If even a humble bird can be led to dance at the altar of random chance, how much of our own daily ritual is shaped by rewards and routines we don't see? Are we truly authors of our lives, or do we, too, move to the invisible rhythms of conditioning? Skinner offered one bold answer, unsettling to many, yet impossible to ignore. He chose to look unflinchingly at the cords that bind behavior to consequence, believing that by grasping those cords firmly, humanity could guide its own fate with a sure hand. Whether that vision is a promise of liberation or a threat to our cherished idea of free will remains an open question. It lives on in every debate about nature versus nurture, in each new social program that tries to change behavior, and in the code of every algorithm that nudges our choices. In the basement lab, the pigeon's dance goes on, a small, determined ritual that reflects a larger human drama. Skinner continues to watch, pencil in hand, unwavering in his faith that understanding behavior is the key to changing it. And we, standing just outside that box, are left to ponder where freedom ends and conditioning begins.